Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
It's the production season.
Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain marketing economist. He agrees we're watching dynamic markets right now, but what's ahead?
You know, it's we're determining supplies right now, and particularly for corn and for soybeans and for the northern crops for wheat, and we're all trying to gauge how much are through those supply demand balance sheets, how much we end up or for ending stocks, how tight will things get, and then whatever we have left or we think we'll have left, we'll gauge prices accordingly, and for say for soybeans or for wheat, if things get tight from the northern states, then the prices move up to ration demand, so we don't get too tight here domestically. That's the way I kind of piece this together.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This is the number one issue facing my members, cannabis and hemp regulators.
At a hearing called Hemp in the Modern World last week, Dr. Jillian Schauer, Executive Director, Cannabis Regulators Association.
Because of a broad definition of hemp in the 2018 Farm Bill, we have seen an explosion of hemp-derived products that are intoxicating, that are not regulated to be safe for consumers, and that can appeal to and be accessed by youth. Red states, blue states, every state is grappling with this issue. Intoxicating hemp-derived cannabinoids, including Delta-8, HHC, THCO acetate, H4 CBD, are being made chemically using CBD as a source material. Many of these compounds have not been studied for safety. People consuming them are literally the test case for their safety, and yet they are widely available across all states in gas stations, grocery stores, and online. Farm Bill compliant cannabinoid hemp products can also contain far more Delta-9 THC than is legal in state-regulated marijuana markets, and yet still be under the 0.3% Delta-9 THC threshold. They can contain high levels of THCA, which readily converts to Delta-9 THC when heated in products. And products marketed as full-spectrum or whole plant CBD that contain all of the compounds found in the hemp plant can also have enough Delta-9 THC to be intoxicating. Hemp and marijuana come from the same plant and have the same compounds. Whether Delta-9 THC comes from what we call hemp or marijuana, it works the same in the body, yet is federally the federal legality of it differs based on the source. The Farm Bill did not create a federal regulatory structure to adequately protect consumers. Cannabinoid hemp products are sold to anyone, anywhere, without any standards or federal regulations. These products, whether intoxicating or not, have no required testing for contaminants, pesticides, heavy metals. They are not regulated federally for ingredients or additives, particularly those that could be harmful when smoked or vaped. They have no required packaging and labeling to tell consumers what's in the product and whether they are intoxicating. There are no federal restrictions on products that mimic commercial food and candy, and kids can access intoxicating hemp products because there are no federal age restrictions. This is in stark contrast to state-regulated marijuana markets, which are highly regulated for consumer safety and youth prevention. States have seen a range of public health and safety issues directly linked to intoxicating cannabinoid products, including accidental ingestion by young kids resulting in hospitalization, overconsumption by teenagers resulting in hospitalization, and unexpected impairment by adults who thought they were purchasing something non-intoxicating. With no federal regulation in place, state legislatures are enacting policy state by state. Policy differs, but increasingly states are bringing intoxicating hemp products under the purview of the marijuana regulator, where the same cannabinoids, but derived from marijuana, are being regulated. Without federal minimum standards, we are creating a patchwork of regulation that creates consumer safety and market challenges and leaves regulatory gaps that cannot be covered by states alone, including in online markets and through interstate commerce. As an association of state regulators, CANRA is not encouraging the recriminalization of cannabinoid hemp products, but rather comprehensive regulation that protects consumers and public health across a range of available products. We have an opportunity to learn from the approaches that states have taken to set thoughtful and comprehensive federal regulatory policy. A federal regulatory agency with a focus on public health and safety, like FDA, needs to be authorized and funded with a specific time frame in which to implement a regulatory framework for these products. And that framework cannot just focus on CBD. It must contend with the breadth of hemp-derived cannabinoids we see on the market today, both intoxicating and non, and it must account for those products we do not yet know about. It must consider the many ways cannabinoid hemp products are consumed, as foods, as beverages, vaped products, smoked products. It must also require contaminant testing and compliance and enforcement. These essential components of a regulatory framework for cannabinoid hemp extend beyond traditional food and dietary supplement pathways.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Groups like ours play a few different roles.
Caitlin Glover is Executive Director for the Public Lands Council, talks about why it's important for groups like the PLC to represent landowners and ranchers.
One is sort of the watchdog, right? Because there are a lot of rules, a lot of regulations that come into play that, again, you know, the devil's in the details. They may look good on paper, but they just might not work in the country. But we also play the role of translator, right? What they mean in the country, but also what the country's priorities are coming back to these agencies. And that's particularly important on a proposed rule like this one, where you look at the proposed rule entitled Conservation and Landscape Health and think, that's great. We all love conservation. We all want better landscape health. But then you take a look at each of the provisions and notice that conservation leasing, as it's proposed in the rule, has never really been done before on federal land. And, oh, by the way, it could preclude other activities. It could force grazing or mining or recreation off of federal land. Might sound great to have the public more involved in these processes, but what would it actually mean on the landscape, and how would it work in real time? That's where we play the role of organizing this engagement, of educating members of Congress and really pointing them in the right direction for how to represent their own constituents. On this proposed rule, our role looks a lot like fighting back against some of the agencies, I think what they would call their best ideas, but really still being constructive because, as they have done for the past 50 years, hopefully we'll look ahead into the next 50 years as to the agencies as partners. We want to prevent things like this proposed rule that would eliminate or undercut or compromise that partnership. We have to be good partners to them, right? And they need to be good partners to us as well.
Now, Mary Thomas Hart is chief counsel with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, talks about Waters of the U.S.
I think that this panel of justices included two former clerks of Justice Kennedy. And that means a lot for a particular reason. Justice Kennedy, if you remember back in 2006 in the Rapanos case, he was the one in the 4-1-4 decision, and he authored the significant nexus test. So not only did you have a fractured opinion from the court, no clear majority, but then the controlling opinion was one that was so vague that we had an additional 13 years of litigation and rulemaking to even attempt figuring out how the significant nexus test worked. And as we saw, the court eventually just gave up on it, right, and went with something else. But I think that those two justices, Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, learned that it's so important at the end of the day to have a clear majority in cases like this. And even though a Justice Kavanaugh may have wanted to do something on his own or kind of veer away from the three liberal justices or the majority of justices on the other side, he didn't. And he wrote the, I guess, concurring in the order, which is really kind of a dissent to the continuous service connection test. And in that opinion, he said, you know, I'm going to voice my concerns with this new test that the court is establishing, but I'm not proposing an alternative because I don't want there to be any confusion about what is the law of the land, what is the standard for EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers going forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
What movement we see in the feed grains, a lot of that's mainly because of weather. What we see in the in soybeans, that's weather on reduced acreage.
Kansas State grain marketing economist Dan O'Brien.
I would say when you look at cash prices, it's interesting that we've seen in our bellwether markets, the corn price say in Garden City with a basis of a dollar over the futures, a cash basis at 633, new crop bids, 572, 30 cents over. And we see pretty good prices all around the rest of the state. Again, Columbus, 618, Colby, $6.13, about $6 in Topeka, about so in Hutchinson, about $5.68 in Salina. So we see some pretty good corn prices. You do see for grain sorghum prices, especially now as we've got these bids coming in, strongest positive basis actually in Columbus, 30 over $5.63. In the export-oriented areas, you've got Topeka showing up pretty well at 25 over, but really everywhere with a positive cash basis for grain sorghum. So we start looking at how strong export numbers for sorghum affect the market. Well, we look at the cash basis, see if it's showing the strength, and those numbers are positive right now. I would say for soybeans, all soybean prices, and here we're almost at the end of July, a new crop coming on, and we're looking at across the state at these areas we cover top prices over $14. So that's just indicative of the type of challenge and worry that people have in those markets. And for wheat, we're seeing prices uniformly at the main markets that we're following. On the low side, 8.11 out in Colby, to the high side, 8.56 in both Salina and Hutchinson. So again, pretty strong wheat prices. And really the issue there is, as we get talking about wheat, is who has it to sell. That's the issue. It won't be long now. We're at the end of July, just about the end of August. Give us 1 or 2 months, we'll be thinking about answering the question of gosh, do we have moisture to go forward and seed wheat in the fall? So that as you and I talk in 30 days, that'll be the next topic for the wheat market that we'll be discussing.
What's ahead?
On the domestic side, we're heading into the August report, and we will get a new measure of what the USDA NAS thinks or is forecasting for yields. We had dropped those numbers from 181.5 in the May, June, or projections down to 177.5 U.S. yields in the July numbers. Will we stay at that number? Will we drop to 175, 174, something like that? You know, again, it's not so much what I say, but what, as we mentioned earlier, what Chip Redman is forecasting that really affects that crop. So right now, it's a weather-driven situation. If that happens, think about corn. We have, again, high enough acres that we would have to get below 173, 174 thereabouts to really get below 2 billion bushels carry out. And we'd need probably get to 2 billion or below to really see things tighten up. And that hasn't happened. That seems to be challenging at least at this time, unless the dry conditions just continue and pervade. I would say for soybeans, that's, as we mentioned earlier, we're now heading into August, just about on the verge of August starting. And the USDA projected 52 bushels per acre yields on tighter acres. And if we stay hot and dry, we start coming off 52 bushels an acre down to 50.5, down to 49 or something less, then in essence, it's not difficult with lower acres to see us getting down to about 100 million bushels or so, and things really tightening up. So we have the potential to see all that much more volatility in the soybean market. And that's what the prices are showing. And I'd say for wheat, Our pervading issue is, again, how tight do things have to get overseas for U.S. wheat exports to actually start up again? And that's kind of an open question. I think in coming weeks, we'll continue to watch for that answer.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Water is really the most critical nutrient that we have for beef cattle.
Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist Dr. Mark Johnson.
If we think about beef animals, water is over 50% of their weight. It's involved in the regulation of temperature, something that's extremely critical this time of year. It's involved in dealing with all kinds of stress, and particularly heat stress. And so we take a little time this week to talk about some ballpark estimates of just how much water a cow actually needs that's in production. And the interesting thing about water and water requirements for a cow from day to day, it's going to be influenced a lot by her stage of production, whether or not she's a dry or lactating cow. And even as we think about those different stages, does she milk really heavy? Does she milk really light? Is also going to influence her daily water requirements. The mature size of that cow and just how big she is going to play a role in how much water she needs each day. And we get into the type of grass that we see cows running on. And this time of year, as we look at whether it's Bermuda grass, native grass pastures, that dry matter content of that forage gets a lot higher and there's less moisture. We may be grazing the same pastures and the same grasses that 2 or 3 months ago might have been a much higher moisture content than those are as a more mature grass right now. And cows can meet their water requirements just by ingesting straight sources of water, as well to some extent by that moisture content that's in whatever feed that they're consuming. So that plays a role as well. It gets interesting thinking about all those different things, just how much water a cow is going to consume. We can reference an OSU fact sheet that came out a few years ago and come up with some pretty good estimates of just how much water a mature cow needs day to day. The other thing that's going to influence the water intake of cows is just the temperature. And we're going to talk a little more about heat stress in next week's episode. But on a 90 degree day, a 1,300 pound dry cow needs about 14 gallons of water a day. A 1,500 pound cow that milks pretty heavy, maybe is giving 30, 35 pounds of milk a day, is going to need well over 20 pounds of water in a typical day. The more the heat and humidity goes up, those requirements get even higher. As we see that temperature go down, those requirements actually are reduced a little bit. And so it's the time of year that we typically get more concerned about things that may cause heat stress. We need to keep an eye on our water sources. We've dealt with some dry conditions in Oklahoma the last couple years. I know in a lot of cases we may still have stock water ponds that are a little bit low. So take into consideration what your cows need as far as daily water requirements. Some general rules of thumb to keep in mind. For every 10 degrees the temperature goes up over 40 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to bump the daily water requirement of a cow by about a gallon. For every each additional gallon of milk that a cow gives, you're going to bump her daily water requirements by about a gallon as well. It's almost a one-to-one relationship relative to the amount of milk produced and the amount of water that a cow is going to need.
Learn more online at extension.okstate.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The overwhelming debt situation in the U.S. is very much on the forefront of congressional members' minds.
Cody Besson, CEO, Plains Cotton Growers.
But they also know, too, that, you know, if you pigeonhole farm policy in general, it's less than 2% of the entire federal budget. And a gentleman that was at a meeting we were at the other day with Senator Cornyn said it very well, that if we can't, you know, muster up enough financial support to essentially create a level playing field for producers to continue to operate in a seamless manner to compete in a world market to provide food, fuel, and fiber for everyone across the globe, be it underserved or those that are served within the system, then we probably need to take a second look at our priorities a little bit and our, you know, core morals, I guess, if you will. And I thought that was very well stated. And certainly the members of Congress, I think, would certainly agree that it's a small financial based initiative to keep us very competitive and keep people fed and clothed across the world. So within that kind of realm, we've got, you know, certainly large champions within the area that are helping with that. Jody Arrington, being chairman of the budget committee, is certainly helping try to make that case and advocate for the financial means to build into place a more permanent farm bill policy that helps us continue to be advocates and continue to be those that provide for families across the globe and in a world and global market. And that tees up and helps set up the ability for then Chairman G.T. Thompson to work with his committee folks and staff to write a more robust farm bill. And then same thing on the Senate side. Certainly you have Chairwoman Stabenow that has a unique perspective in her part of the world, her part of the U.S. on what their growers need. And then you have Ranking Member John Bozeman, who certainly understands the value and the importance of the ag industry in the southern portion of the U.S. hemisphere, and understands the real value of it. We have to have the financial means to develop a more robust farm bill, or else, you know, why would we go through the motions at this point to make any changes and just do a straight extension until we provide financial capability to do that? And he certainly made that very clear in his comments, and I think that's a very robust task to make that point very clear that it's not worth doing unless it's worth doing right is the best way to say that. And certainly we're on the notion of doing it right and making sure that everybody has a good, robust farm policy moving forward with Ranking Member Bozeman.
One thing not part of the farm bill is an issue with Mexico. Andrew Brandt with the U.S. Grains Council.
Our friends down in Mexico, which has traditionally been the number one market for corn in the last two decades, all but one year, they were the number one export destination for U.S. corn. Their president has issued a biotech decree, which the first iteration of essentially said we want to buy no more biotech corn by 2024. They updated that decree this February, and specifically on white corn used in tortillas and other food products, they want no GMO corn. But that decree also includes a provision that says we still do want to also phase out all GMO corn completely, even from animal feed, as that is attainable. So we, of course, object to that. It's not that we are forcing them to buy GMO corn. It's more we completely object to a government policy that prohibits it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
With regard to the changes in weather patterns, weather conditions for crops, in Kansas, but beyond that into the central, eastern, northern corn belt, and you name it. We just have a lot of things domestic that are affecting domestic U.S. crop production potential.
Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain market economist.
We have most of our hard red winter wheat crop in, but still struggling with issues up in the northern plains for white wheat, for hard red spring, for durum. Much less what we're seeing in terms of hot dry conditions affecting corn, some of those critical time frames, but still having a big effect on the crop. Heading now into for soybeans, the time of flowering. Again, a lot of the old standby viewpoints were that we make corn in July, we make soybeans in August, and without doubt, I know Chip Redmond in our house here at K-State has a lot to say about all of that in terms of hot, dry conditions. And so a lot of what I would have to say would work off of what our climatologists, people like Chip, would have to say too. So, and in response to that, so we moved into changing futures prices on Thursday the 27th. Corn closed at 5.33 and a quarter. New crop beast contract 5.42 and a quarter also. Both those down 6 or 7 cents. But the broader picture of where we've been moving for corn, we've been had traded down to about $4.70, as high as about $5.65 in the last 4 or 5 days, and are now at $5.33. And I guess from a price point of view, it's a welcome surprise. Quite often, if we'd had no problems with production in the United States for corn, we probably would have gone down below $5 and just stayed there. But now we have issues that we're wrestling with. So, and when you look for soybeans, a pretty similar situation. You've got August closing at $15.32, and we're just about to enter into what we call the contract delivery time frame to close out that contract. Again, $15.32, September, $14.53, November, just under $14. And in terms of price trends, we're seeing soybeans not having, I guess, just come up to previous highs, but we have now exceeded them. Previous highs going way back to January were about $15.20 or so, and now we've traded up as high as about over $15.75, have come down some off of that. So strong times in the soybean futures market, and I think the underlying issue there has to do with how the USDA had dropped in the end of June acreage report, had dropped soybean acres about 4 million acres and had raised corn about 2, and the reason we're seeing the soybean market in response to hot, dry conditions be so much more responsive than the corn market is just, again, we chopped acres so much. So that's a highly scientific university term, i.e. we chopped acres. But the USDA did drop acres that much for soybeans, and now it just exacerbates any bit of worry that we have in that. For us, as hard red winter wheat producers here in Kansas, we had so many problems all throughout this market here, the farther west we had gone. And so now those that have wheat that were blessed to be able to get a crop out are, did they sell at harvest? Have they held? If we're seeing now a jump up in wheat prices almost, well, to over 925 on the high end of trade, closed yesterday at 866 and a half.
It's Kansas State grain marketing economist Dan O'Brien. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We still have 44% of the nation's rangeland and pastures rated in good to excellent condition. That's a 3-point drop from the previous week, but very poor to poor ratings were steady this week at 24%.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Leading the nation this week is Missouri, 59%, very poor to poor. Texas is next on the list at 48%, followed by Michigan, 44%, and Illinois at 43%. Now, we still have some pretty green pastures for this time of year, especially in the southeast, then extending northward all the way into the Ohio Valley and beyond. In the southeast, we see more than 70% of the pastures rated good to excellent on July 23rd. In Alabama, Tennessee, and Kentucky. We also see that true in California, remarkable for this time of year, 70% good to excellent, and also Wyoming at 79%.